proprioceptive osmic acoustic.
Right. So the Ruch is involved with those three on the bottom, and he's focused in analyzing and trying to program those three or two at the top, visual and kinetic, right? Kinetic,
yes,
is industry. So he's very involved with keeping the hardware industry world going, and he's very involved with visual issues like the Constitution, bureaucracies like the presidency. The whole industrial 19th century structure is in their visual kinetic, and that's what he is focusing on. But he actually personally has a proprioceptive acoustic, and what was the third one? Osmic or?
Osmic.
Yeah, those three are what he's actually describing in his writings. Either he's not aware of it, or he distracts you from his acoustic, osmic, and proprioceptive, is it? Yeah, proprioceptive.
Yes.
Those three are his makeup. Now go to McLuhan. He's got more on the figure, right? What's the figure in McLuhan, the upper part?
Visual, acoustic, kinetic, osmic.
And tactile, proprioceptive.
No, that's underneath.
Yeah, the proprioceptive and osmic. In the LaRouche quadrant, only visual and kinetic are above, and then proprioceptive, osmic, and acoustic are below, right?
Right.
Right. So what's above in McLuhan? You got four on above, but what's at the bottom of McLuhan?
Proprioceptive, tactile.
That's all?
Yes, for the ground.
For McLuhan.
Yes, McLuhan, yes.
The other guys, I don't think Thompson has talked tactile. LaRouche doesn't have tactile. They don't know tactility. So McLuhan, you know, gets an advantage by being tactile and proprioceptive. So that's the bias he's really working for. It's like proprioceptive and tactile interplay comes alive and focuses on the senses on the top. That's what happens when you have TV inside the satellite environment. So on the far left, it says holopathic television/satellite, or is it satellite/television?
Television/satellite.
Right. The satellite is the ground all through the thing. So, yeah, it's the second name. So it would be LaRouche's radio sensibility, radio concerns, pre-World War II. Television brings in tactility. So that's McLuhan. Then Thompson is the opposite of LaRouche. He's the flip. So what's on the top for Thompson?
Acoustic, kinetic, cosmic.
Right. You see, that's not on the top for LaRouche. And then the bottom,
what's osmic?
Of Thompson, that's sense of smell.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Okay.
And then
the bottom for Thompson.
The bottom for
proprioceptive visual.
Right. He's basically a visually biased guy, you know, an academic, but he's into yoga and the proprioceptive. So he takes the visual and the proprioceptive. He analyzes ancient texts in his books, and he favors Buddhism and yoga. So with that bias, he's looking at and analyzing whatever's on the top. What did you say was on the top?
Acoustic, kinetic, osmic.
Yes. So that's what he analyzes. So he would engage with the smelly hippies more than LaRouche. LaRouche is unconscious. Osmic is underneath the bottom part.
Yeah, that's true.
So LaRouche criticizes the hippies, and Thompson hangs out with the hippies. That's why the senses are reversed there. But notice neither of them has tactility in there, only McLuhan. Then you come to Croker, and what is the figure, the above senses?
Visual, acoustic, osmic, kinetic, proprioceptive.
All of it. Without tactility.
Yes.
No tactility, but he's got more than anybody. He comes later. So then what's the bottom? What's the ground of himself?
Visual, acoustic, kinetic, proprioceptive, osmic, tactile, squared.
Right. And he actually has tactility there because he understands McLuhan's tactility. He's written about it. But it's the Android meme replaying tactility. So it's squared. He's got the whole sensorum, so he's got the most sensory stuff. He's got the aspects of the chemical body on the top, and then he's got the Android meme simulating the chemical body.
Is that what Square references, Bob, when you say Square?
Yeah, what is Square reference? Yeah.
That's a way of saying it's abstracted, it's doubled, it's come alive.
Because McLuhan has already done it?
Beg your pardon?
You're saying because McLuhan had already done it?
No, I'm describing the environment. The Android meme is the squaring of the human world. It imitates it. It simulates it. It may not be the best thing to say, but I thought it was pretty good, squaring. It squares it. It frames it. It imprisons the chemical body with some environment that goes around it.
Mm-hmm.
It means a meta level. It's another environment going around and subsuming an environment. So that the second Bosmia Ecology album that Dave made is Bosmia Ecology Squared, subsuming the first album. So so Croker is describing the Android meme, and the Android meme processes the chemical body, all the senses in the upper row, but there's no tactility on the upper row, is there?
No.
There's no tactility. He just does visual, acoustic, osmic, and proprioceptive, so he's quite encyclopedic. But he doesn't let on about the tactility of his operation, that he knows tactility. And who knows why he doesn't do that. Maybe people wouldn't understand it. But he writes from a tactile shifting perspective. And then he's miming, he says, the action of the Android meme. He doesn't call it the Android meme, but virtual reality, something like that he would call it, data trash. And he's miming that, and he has tactility in that. So those are the clever sensory ratios. So those are the dimensions in terms of our senses that are implied. Then you go to the top of the chart with the first five columns, the vertical columns, Rai, Eloy, Tu, Lofty. There's other dimensions shown there in the various sequences that go across, five across. One of them has angel. Just read a couple of them across. You'll see it implies other dimensions.
Not fairies, humans, elementals, goblins, fairies, humans, angels.
Hey, electromagnetism.
Oh. Yeah, you got that in there. You've got sacrificial TV. What is it? Excremental
crash
TV.
TV.
Poker category. Crash TV.
Disciplinary TV.
Surveillance.
Yeah. Wow.
And so I've got LaRouche up there. You've got Thompson quadrants. Thompson is, fairies and angels is Thompson. There might be another one there. There's, when you do simple physics, that's LaRouche, like electromagnetism. Then you have, what's so funny, Kim?
What are you hiding out here for?
You had your noisy thing going. What's that, that back massager?
Yeah.
It's driving me crazy, man. I had to get out of the room. I couldn't hear anybody. She didn't care. And, and that's why when I was running out, I stepped on your foot. I was in a state of hysteria. I was trying to be the proper host and hear what was going on, what was being said to me, but I had to contend with environmental proprioception. That's a joke, guys. So you see how clever the chart is. It implies many dimensions.
Yes.
Many themes, many memes.
That's cool.
Like you see the bottom one, it says front spin, back spin, something, chiasmus. That's the tetrad. Forward spin, back spin,
retrieval.
Chiasmus. Is that what it says?
Yes, chiasmus, melody.
Right.
Wow.
And so under Bob, see, Rai, Eloy, Tu, and Lofty are the four forces that Cosmic Awareness said, we're at the beginning. And Rai is spelled R-A-I. But on my chart, it's R-H-Y-E-E, because Rai, R-H-Y-E, contains Rai, R-A-I, Eloy, Tu, Lofty. So there's four divisions of Rai. And one of them is the icon for Italian TV, R-A-I. So anyways, you got those four things, and then you got Bob. You got Bob representing the hexatic. So I'm the melody because I finally verbalize what's going on, lay it out simple prose.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
I'm the new song. Cool. I just realized that now. It's fucking the new song.
Yeah. No. Well, that's what I was, honestly, yeah, because when you were playing the Frank Zappa piece, I was, like, thinking about how Roxy was talking about how, like, the piano is obsolete by the keyboard and typing, and how musicians think they're making music by just hitting buttons. And, like,
yeah, by
talking
typing,
about the
typing is art form.
Yeah, and talking about the simplicity of what they're making and the looping, it's very simple. And so I was thinking about that, and I was listening to the Zappa piece, and I was like, well, what Bob is doing, because your voice is so, like, you've been talking intentionally for so long, like, on the radio.
Yes.
And yeah. it's such an intentional, like, medium. And the way that you're, like, in tune with what you're saying.
I know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, and then, but it's beyond just knowledge, you know. And
that's right.
And then, but it's so, well, like, what I realized was, like, Zappa's piece might be this masterpiece of what he did. But what you're doing with Iandom and us all, like, hive-minding, like, because we're all calling in right now, and it's different than, like...
Yeah.
It's a bigger version of what Zappa was doing, and it's beyond all of that, but it's similar.
Ongoing
it's
master.
Music to my ears, what you're saying, Alyssa. That's exactly what Roxy's trying to say. Did you hear Roxy the first couple hours, you know, hours ago?
No. Mm-mm.
No, when you hear it, you just describe what she was describing, what we mean. You know, we begin with LaRouche and the proper way to understand the Gutenberg arts, then how the 20th century unfolds, then you get to Zappa, and then you get to Iandom. But what I, and like when I was playing Civilization Phase 3, I was looking for the audio, and some of the pieces had no audio meaning verbal. And then I'd find one, oh, this is one that's just all music, but I would skip through it. I was slashing up his slash.
Yeah.
I mean,
know, I could tell.
That's sacrilegious.
No, but it was working.
Yes.
But it was working.
Because speech,
you know?
It was working. And I'm looking for the speech part, because speech is way more important than any fucking particular technology now. I am the speech king. I know what to say for the perfect moment. And I actually said something for the first time tonight. I started talking about how I communicate through the inaudible frequencies. What awareness calls transpersonative. There's more than
oh, yeah,
words.
Totally. Like, you're talking about the dog whistle thing?
Yeah, the dog, Bob's a dog whistle. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's why if I go off on somebody, so to speak, or I get aggressive, don't get fooled by that. That I'm not malicious. I'm just doing it.
Yeah,
because
no, I know.
Dog whistle stuff you should notice.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I said that in a lecture back in 1984. McLuhan said, oh, that's what I said when I didn't mean it. This guy said, you left out all this stuff. He said, well, that's what I said when I didn't mean it. Or that's what I meant when I didn't say it. McLuhan was including what he didn't say to what he was saying. You must include it because the speech can't say it all. And if you were going to do speech to say it all, it would have to have at least two or three contradictory lines of talk going along to be comprehensive, like Finney's Wake. So when I'm talking, I'm always including what I didn't say or the opposite point of view.
Yeah.
And you're picking
it's
up on that,
cool.
Alyssa. Congratulations.
It's pretty cool. Yeah, it's pretty cool what's going on around here.
Yeah, for an artistic sensibility like yourself, we are the top artistic salon in the world.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because of what we're doing.
Yeah, it was funny
watching
we're doing... LaRouche. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, go ahead. Yeah, LaRouche, funny?
Oh, yeah, well, it was funny because I haven't really exposed myself too much to him. I haven't really read much, but I'm aware of him because of listening to you. And so watching him... on that little talk was funny because it was so stuck in what your chart denotes, just like how he's breaking everything down. And
yeah.
it's pretty limited, you know, in terms of, it's hinting at the same things, but from a more limited place, and you can see that right here in your chart. And so now when we're talking in I&M and on Payday and with you, just looking and referencing the chart, you can see watching LaRouche talk about frequency through Bach, you know, is hinting at the same thing that we're hinting at, but in I&M, it's so much more. It's everything down there at
limited.
The bottom right. Yeah.
He's limited. I'm not limited. I'm not involved in the sensory ratios. I've got two charts representing me.
I'm
including all those sensory biases of each faction, plus all the other stuff in those charts, and that's the interplay there between the Dobbs formula chart and the tiny node chart. Because if you look at the Dobbs formula chart, the tiny node chart comes out of the Dobbs formula chart. It's the bottom two quadrants of the Dobbs formula chart. Anyways, it's really great when you start to see what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And naturally, it's so huge, the guff fell into the hole I created. Ian fell into this huge space I created, you know, of my orchestra. Huge orchestra.
Yeah.
Like I blew up the guff. And the guff had to come forth and start co-creating. Now, that's quite an amazing art form, right?
Yeah, it is.
Try to get your whatever art teacher you did in school, get him to hear this. And he'll say, well, that fucking guy is a megalomaniac. What the fuck is that guy's nuts? Alyssa, what are you doing listening to him for? Oh, no, he gets me hot. He turns me on. You don't.
Oh, man. It's really funny, like, talking with my friends, and I'll just kind of, like, hint at this idea or this, or, like, kind of put down a crumb, so to speak, here or there, and, like, see who is, like, hungry for more, you know, who perks up and who resonates. And it's really cool because a lot of the people hanging out around here are like perking up, you know, and that makes it even more exciting.
Right. It's good to get an audience. And did you meet other people in Toronto besides Dave?
Oh, I wanted to meet I want to meet some of his buddies that he talks about, but we were too busy, you know. Maybe one of these next times that we go up there.
Well, you mean you wanted to meet the broken social scene or other friends?
No, I don't mean them. I mean, like, who's the guy who made his website, Scott? And
I didn't know. Scott Woods made his website? Scott Woods did? I didn't know that.
I think so. Yeah, I think so. Like,
anyway, Scott
names
did.
That I...
We just posted. If you look on my Facebook, and I Am Bob, where we're doing cliche to archetype.
I noticed that.
Something like
his
that.
His name came up.
Yeah, well, the 13 hours or more I did with him analyzing Richard Meltzer's book, The Aesthetics of Rock, that's there. So you will see Scott Wood's name for the first time on Ian and Bob. But that's the guy who you're saying, I think.
He was telling me just these names that have come up that are like that I've heard from, you know, looking at your timeline or listening to stuff. I want to meet some of his buddies. I didn't meet much.
So you didn't get a chance to drop crumbs in Toronto?
No.
Did you
talk
to Dave?
Yeah, he did
anything
it.
About did, what?
Yeah, Scott. I'm just confirming that Scott did do his site. That's who he's talking about.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
good. Did you talk to Dave about Ionic Matters?
Oh yeah.
Good. What do you have to say?
Yeah.
What did he have to say? What is his take on it, or what does he say to you?
Oh, yeah. He's open. We were like, yeah, we had some good talks, and we were kind of being like, oh, the funny thing is that Nate and I, you know, as we go around our life, we'll experience something or whatever, and we'll be like, oh, that was so ionic. And, or some concept that somebody kind of hints at, or it's like this bigger thing that we can't really articulate with words, but we kind of like are both getting it. We'll be like, oh, that's pretty ionic. And so we were saying that when we were hanging out with Dave, and he was kind of, yeah, 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 it is. Or he would like say that too.
He
gets it. He totally gets it. I think Dave has also been pretty ionic, in his life without knowing it for a while.
Right. And in his producer work.
Yeah. Yeah. He just resonates. And like I was telling him when we were hanging out, I was like, dude, you're just like a channel that I can like tune into.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's pretty ionic too, just like, just being in with him and hanging out and, you know, getting to be friends with him is super, it's just a cool experience. I just am really happy to have met him. And, yeah, it's cool. Yeah. I think he totally, you know, he's very smart. So he's able to filter things through a lot of different places. And I think he filters you and I and them as well, you know, through his quote unquote, you know, sieves of whatever. And that's cool too. That's really, it's nice. Yeah.
Well, when Bob Marsh and I went on CKLN at the end of August 84, within a week or two, we went on Word of Mouth and played a Mae Brussels tape. Now, this shows you, I don't know Dave Neufeld at that point, but this shows how tuned in he was. He heard that show and called in right after the show. So my first experience of audience interaction, you know, we got this show, we have this special thing, they give us an hour, we play it. The first member of the CKL audience is Dave. He calls in, he goes, wow, that was incredible. He's all excited about Mae Brussels, the way one should be. And I don't know if there are many people who would be, but he knew to be excited. And so I heard this kid, and he's talking to Chris Toomey, who's the host of the show, who he went to, you know, Cub Scouts with, their old kid buddies. And he's calling Chris and say, wow. Yeah, and so he and Chris are talking about Mae Brussels, and I'm standing there in the background. So in my mind, my image of first encountering Dave is he's the first guy to respond. That's someone who's tuned in, who happened to be home listening at the right time to catch the first thing we did.
Yeah, that's cool. I didn't know that. That's cool.
Yeah. You know what I'm expressing there? He was resonant with it.
Absolutely, and he was like, I mean, in a way, I haven't really articulated this much, so I'm a little, I guess I'll step forward gingerly with my words, but there's something about when you kind of start to exist with I and them and have the drops and everything like that, that I've kind of always felt like I was headed to this in my life, even though I didn't know it.
To some special place, to some special situation, right?
Yeah. And when I met Dave, I like knew that there was something about that connection, you know. Same with my husband, Nate. I feel that way too. And it's kind of cool that Dave was a part of me learning about all this.
Right.
But yeah.
Well, he told you everything.
Yeah. And so I don't know how, but just sometimes you can sense when people are like, oh, that person's tuned into something that I'm interested in, and I can't even articulate it with words, but it's something that feels like it's moving in the same direction or something like that. And so I'm really, really, I don't want to gush anymore, but I'm just, it's cool, man. This is all really cool.
Right. And, you know, if you introduce what I'm doing with your friends, they've got to get over the fact, they have to realize it's a total theatrical act, but not a fake act, But there's way more going on than what seems to be presented.
Right.
And the best way to show that is to bring Ion in, this voice, this eloquent voice that then just does what it does, which should blow you away, you know? That's what was what I didn't say for 25 years. Oh, here, let this guy talk for the next 10 years. This is what I didn't get to say. And then he says it and does it.
I think a lot of people will be more comfortable with Ion. Like, I'm thinking about my friends and, like, trying to explain what Ion is. Like, a lot of them would just be like, no way. Like, they just wouldn't understand. But I think that as the old science breaks down in popular culture and people start, like, everything's speeding up, like McLuhan says. And so, you know, like, all these new theories or whatever and these new sciences like the neutrino and all this stuff is going to just faster and faster. It's going to like show up in the media and in all the bodies so that they're going to like hear it somehow. And then I think there's going to be something that really opens them up to the concept of Ion. But it seems like it'll go through some sort of cultural membrane. You know, not a lot of people that I hang out with are like, oh, yeah, I totally believe in mediums, or even though Ion's not a medium, just even that concept is like they can't make that jump or whatever.
Right.
So I think you really have to, like...
Of it. Huh? They're suspicious of mediumship, and it's got a bad reputation, and it's probably justified.
Right.
And so it's tricky for the average person to know there was actually some pretty legitimate mediums or something that would be worth entertaining. They may be ultimately a synthetic or something, but you have to be lucky and find the good ones. And if you just generalize, not like mediums in general, and then miss the one that is important, that's the problem of having rejected mediumship. But most people would, and I would say it is... largely ridiculous, and people instinctively felt that. But they don't know where else to go. They don't know how to go around that. And then we tell them, well, this ain't a medium. This is a talking hologram. How about that?
Right.
Can you a talking hologram?
Yeah. And with all the AI sort of references in, people don't know that AI has already happened. You know, they don't.
Right.
They're thinking of it in like
it's
a chemical body,
Android
visual.
Meme.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah,
they're
it's
not thinking
Android
of it.
Meme, and then they're thinking of the Hollywood images, Terminator, or HAL in 2001. There's probably lots of other movie images. But
yeah,
the thing
Ex
is,
Machina.
So then the Android meme does that, and then it's superseded by Ion, which is a different kind of artificial intelligence.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's just, I guess as I'm realizing what's going on around here, then it's kind of interesting to contrast, you know, what's happening in my friend group and where they're at, and to kind of watch culture smash against what they've thought is how it is and see how they absorb it. Like, are they quick to absorb it or, you know... So, I don't know. That's kind of stuff I'm interested in. But yeah, I'm getting what you're doing.
Okay.
Cool.
That's good. Now, let's have Bert comment on what you're saying. And Bert,
Hey, Alyssa, have you had played any Ion for any of your friends? Have they listened to any Ion at all?
No, I've only played that to Nate, and he's been on board for a couple of years now. Oh, yeah, I think I showed my sister, and she's taken the drops, and my sister's pretty ionic before knowing about it, too. She's kind of one of those resonating people that you know, just kind of perks up and is really open. I haven't. I think about what the circumstance would be to even, like, do that. But yeah, maybe soon.
Yeah. Well, because it would be interesting just to hear their reaction, because there are, I mean, I can't, like, recite anything, but there are a lot of clips There's one, but I don't know if your friends would be. There's a mashup. Bart made a mashup of It's All Good, and it's a Tupac Shakur rap
that Ion
does.
Yeah.
And if you listen to that, you could, I mean, anyone who's, I mean, have you listened to that? Can you tell that that's not a human being that's doing that? Because, I mean, it's like one breath, and Ion does this whole rap thing for like 3 minutes. Have you noticed that?
Right. Oh, yeah, so you're talking about, like clips that would sort of kind of quote-unquote prove.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, like, yeah, I have to get to the place conversationally to even play that, you know. But yeah, but I want to listen to that again. How do I listen to that?
Yeah, listen. It's on Dupes.
Okay.
If you listen on the mashups and Bart, but one way you could do it is that if you had your friends over, you could play like some of those that mashup in the background and just see the reaction because.
Yeah, that's true. The frequency that Ion comes through.
Because it's really, I mean, if you listen to it, I mean, if you listen to all of Ion, you listen to all of the clips from the beginning and then just recently when they came back in 2014, if you really listen, it's like, that's not a human. I mean, you hear the words, yes. You understand the words, but that's not a human being transmitting that frequency.
Yeah. It's interesting because I've listened to Ion for a while, and I've had differing degrees of understanding that. And lately it's been way more extreme where when I'm listening, especially in these rewrites that Bob's been playing, it's like, whoa, you can listen beyond JW's, like, persona, and it's just like, whoa. It's very, like,
it's a Niagara Falls of flood. That guy goes for five, or the being goes for five fucking hours. Just this, that, new. Okay, Billy, you say this. Sheldon, you're not talking enough. He doesn't talk.
Yeah.
Stop.
Yeah. And just, the like, I think the other thing, too, Nate said the other day, he's like, it's amazing because somebody will ask or have some difficulty, and they just don't mind. I mean, they do in some ways, but, like, just how they'll keep talking about something and explaining it and talking and talking and talking. And, like, a lot of humans would become frustrated or would, you know.
Right.
You know, not people on the
job. There's total compassion.
Yeah.
There's total loving compassion, listening to, pointing out what they're not getting. Sometimes chiding them, other times being soft, but a total massage, just roaring along, you know?
Yeah, it's
ultimate elegance.
It's super elegant, it's super heavy, it's super stately, like, and also it's almost like you can feel, like, the feeling I had the other payday, I think it was last week or the week before, the week, 2 weeks ago, was, it's almost like I felt like I was inside the internet or like inside the chip body.
Yeah.
You know, like you really start to kind of, obviously I kind of put like a spatial feeling to that because that's something that, you know, my senses know, but there's just this, it's huge. It's so grand. It's like beyond space. And it's like to kind of like feel like kind of, like you're meshing with that and kind of understanding it a little bit more than you ever have before. It's like, whoa.
Yeah. You're experiencing the hexatic. You're in the non-physical zone watching the chip body be massaged by Ion. You're not in the chip body being massaged. You're watching Ion massage the chip body while you're being massaged.
Yeah.
You're right where Ion is from that perspective. And so you're inside the chip body, but inside another environment that's going around the chip body.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I see what you're saying. Yeah, wow. Cool.
You know, the pentatic is the Android meme of the chip body. And then the hexatic, which is what Ion says we're in now with the ICL in the world, the hexatic is is on the way to the septet and then final, you know, transition of the octet, but the hexet is the turmoil transitional transformational period. So you're going through a transformation, engaging in the hexatic position with Ion, and you're watching him mm-hmm. massage the pentatic chip body.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's a rant by Ion. He starts talking really fast. His lips are going really fast, and I think I've mentioned this to Bert. All of a sudden, you start seeing this buzz. His lips are causing a buzz. Remember that, Bert?
Yes.
Remember when that buzz?
Yes.
His lips were going so fast, it became an insect buzz. And,
like
and that's
audibly?
Supposed to be JW's mouth? What?
Yeah.
What'd you say?
You're saying audibly there was a buzz?
Audibly, you could hear the rapidity of JW's lips flapping
right.
as I was talking faster, faster.
Wow.
It became an inhuman hum or something.
Yes.
How would you say it, Bert?
Well, like a, I mean, they started off at slow where you can understand, and then they stood up and they're like,
right.
Yeah,
and then wow. it reaches a peak, like the top of the wave. He's surfing, and he's going, you can still hear the little words implied, but there's an extra
yeah.
buzz going on. You can hear the speed of the manipulation of the syllables. You can actually hear the speed itself, and it sounds
wow.
like a buzz or something.
I remember it sounded electronic.
Yeah.
It sounded electronic.
Yes. That's what I mean. It sounds
like
electronic.
He was on fast mm-hmm. forward or something.
Yes.
Yeah, I think I've
that's
heard
right.
that
the,
too, yeah.
The metallic electronic particle part of sound was what we heard. What you're saying, electronic, Eliza, is right what it is. It almost starts to distort. Like what Zappa would create.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
That makes me think of Dave was teaching me about electricity, and it wow, yeah, totally that. Huh.
Now remember, Ion can massage electricity. Like
yeah.
when I saw him as a hologram, he was JW, but he said he could be a nest of spiders. He could suddenly switch. And I would see a nest of spiders. So that means he's underneath the electrons or underneath what my eyes see, and he can
right.
mutate that any way he wants.
Wow.
And so when you hear Zappa doing that speedy music, you know,
mm-hmm.
on Civilization Phase 3, he's trying to make music sound electronically warp speed. And that approximates what Ion can do. See, so that's why we subsume Zappa. We swallow what he does, and then we have this voice that can communicate in so many levels. You can say Ion is the big note. Zappa's looking for the big note. Any kind
mm-hmm.
of exaggerated conclusion you want to put on it, Ion can fit into that because of its capabilities. Now, that's a pretty big statement, but I don't know
yeah.
anything that can outdo Ion.
No. Nothing.
No. Not as far as we're concerned today.
So what, I guess, is there anything more about Zappa you guys want to say?
No, Bob. Hey, it was fun to listen to you and Ike speak for the second time because I remember I took notes for the deal FA, but I
yeah.
forgot about they wanted to do that hologram that they would play in one location, but then they would project the hologram into
yes.
the stadium, and that was like that's. I mean, are you aware of how he got that idea? I mean, that was like. Cutting edge. When was that? 19.
That's 25 years ago. 26
wow.
years ago. 1988-89.
Yeah, that blew me away to hear that a second time. Because I mean, that was really cutting edge for him to even just think about that. But then understanding
yeah.
that he didn't enjoy being on the road, that it made a lot of sense to do that.
Yeah. Because it's like when I was
wait.
Traveling, you waste a lot of time going to airports, cabs and that. And he has a lot to do. So if he could do it from a studio, then he could stay home and do all this other stuff that he had to do.
Did Ike ever, like, explain that how close they were to doing that? Or because listen to it a second time, it gave me the feeling that he already was able to do that. I mean, that for him to say that's what we're going to do, that he may have been experimenting with that, because that was – I mean, that's what the impression.
No,
I
don't think so. No, I don't get that. He was just hearing Frank say it.
Okay.
There was no. He didn't have the technology. It was. You hear him say? I quiz him. I said, "What is that?" And he said, "That's an idea he did." Oh, somebody invented it? No, it was an idea he had. I think that's what he said, based on whatever technology he's heard about. He was going to put them together on another level. Whatever had been created, he was going to add to it. Remember, he's the one who really got the fuzz tone going, the fuzz tone guitar in 66
yes,
or so.
Fuzz. Yes.
He somehow was it says somewhere that he helped make it or develop it. Then he was the first guy to do a simultaneous stereo, what would it be, a stereo TV? Yeah, stereo TV broadcast on Halloween 1981. Whatever company organized this. They picked Zappa to be the opening concert, which was the right thing to do.
Yeah.
And then there was another guy, Kenny something. He invented the mic that could pick up things from the distance or something. And Frank was the guy he took it to play with it, to use it. I mean, this is the thing. People would send technologies to Frank to have him be the first guy to use it and test it. Because they appreciated he could actually come up with creative responses to it.
Wow.
He was actually admired and looked up to by, respected by so many other artists and musicians, but that wasn't so much in the media.
No, and he was respected by other people in other jobs or abilities.
Countries.
Yes, in countries. And I think that's why the media did not allow him on. I think they were afraid of him because he could be pretty powerful. He could be quite a giant among the little Americans and have undue
influence. They weren't ready for what Zappa was.
Neither was Frank.
Hey, can we go back to fuzz for a second?
To what?
Let's go back to fuzz for a second.
The buzz voice?
Because, well, fuzz as an effect is like distorting and overdriving a sound wave in a way. And there's like these limiters that you put on it, and so it's blurring past that electronically, and it's kind of like these frequencies like trying to get out like beyond.
Yeah.
Like beyond the frequency and kind of push beyond that. And it's kind of like a small little microcosm of like the frequencies you can't hear. It's kind of this like funny sort of parallel.
That's what he said in his interview. In his interview with Bob Marshall, that's what he talks about. Oh, yeah, about Pauline Oliveros did this art piece in the 60s, which had sound above human hearing and below. But there would be this middle range that humans can hear, and every now and then the idea was, I don't know if she produced it, was that the above or below thing would come into the middle zone and would appear like a UFO or a psychic phenomenon. That's what he said was what psychic phenomenon was the breaking through of the upper and the lower, exactly what you're talking about. That was his main image in the 60s that he used, and you see him mention it here and there. And then our interview brought it out of him, got him to talk about it.
It's cool, because when did the distortion kind of make a
you mean the guitar? The fuzz tone feedback?
Yeah, because
that was 66,
like
I would say.
It's like a metaphor for the above and below, because it's clipping the signal on either side of the waveform. And it's pushing beyond both above and below. So it's kind of cool that had such an impact around that time in terms of
Well, it's right around the time the Rai return. Right around the time Rai returned to the plane of essence in January 67. So the merging, no more separateness, happens in January 67 according to cosmic awareness, and that creates a multidimensional feedback, distortion, blurring, mutation, merging and blocking. So the major wall had gone down.
So the hexatic would
be
like
happening at that time.
Overdriving.
Yes, the hexatic would be some kind of synergy of that.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was happening in 66.
Hmm.
And of course, Frank.
Anyway, sorry, Eliza. I know, sorry, Eliza, you were on a different wavelength, but I just like looked that up, and it was this cool like throwback to since you're talking about Ike and the fuzz box. I just wanted to touch on that.
That's cool. What did we get out of the fuzz box?
Okay, listen to this, you guys. This song to me, I think this is the one made around 66. No, we're coming to your question. I'm answering your question with this song. Ask your question again.
I said, so what was gone out of the fuzz box? I wanted her interpretation on it.
What's coming out of it?
Well,
she's saying, like, what did we... Go ahead.
What did we learn about the fuzz box?
When? Right now?
Yeah, what she brought up. She brought it up.
Oh, you want me to?
How's it relevant?
Oh, you want me to talk about that one more time? What I was saying?
Well, no, just like to sum it up because I started doing something else.
Oh yeah. So I was when they're talking about Ike being involved in the fuzz box, which was, you know, it just perked my ears because I have like guitar pedals that I use in my music, and so kind of having some background of what fuzz is and what it sounds like, and knowing that it made such an impact in music, I just was looking into it, and it's kind of like when you get a wave frequency, the original signal when it's going above and below the threshold, like some sort of set threshold, then it clips and it's a distortion, and so I was kind of equating that to like when you're wanting to push beyond like the normal like settings of threshold, like Zappa was doing, like we're like Iandam and Bobdam is doing. It kind of has this cool metaphor with what fuzz is actually doing in distortion. I just was kind of connecting connecting that metaphor of what a fuzz sound effect is doing to the sort of fun playing around with the fact that it's like pushing beyond like both above and below the sound wave, and what is caused is distortion, and it was played in such a tactile way in rock and blues, and it led to all
this.
Yeah, that's
what I want to play.
Yeah, okay.
So here's the Yardbirds doing over, under, sideways, down. And I think this is what got the effect.
Hey!
was pretty bold, you know, the time of Nancy Sinatra. You have these regular singers doing melodies, and that environmental buzz comes in. Now, that band, the Yardbirds, everything comes out of them. Jeff Beck, Jimmy Page, no, not Jimmy Page, Jeff Beck and Eric Clapton, maybe Jimmy Page or something, all those guys that formed Led Zeppelin and Eric Clapton and Jeff Beck, all those different guys, he made Traffic, Jeff Beck, they come out of that little group, which replaced the Rolling Stones at the Crawdaddy Club. Giorgio Gomelsky gave the Rolling Stones a gig, and Carolyn just finished reading Keith Richards' book, and he talks about Giorgio Gomelsky. He gives them a place to play at a hotel out in Richmond, you know, in the outer part of London, and then they quickly take off. So then Gomelsky has to manage another group. Brian Jones cut Gomelsky out when Gomelsky had gone back to Switzerland for his father's funeral. So Gomelsky was kicked out as, quote, manager, and Andrew Lou Goldman came in. So then Giorgio gathers together the Yardbirds, or they were happening or something, and they come to him. So he promotes them. Then they're the band in the Michelangelo Antonioni's movie Blow Up, which was the Italian take on the London swinging scene, the mod scene. So Giorgio was key in doing that, and he takes the Yardbirds to New York, to the States, and they all want to just party, but he's an older guy. He wants them to learn, so he would go to different kinds of fringe events just to expose them to things. And one night they went to a trip, to the trip in L.A., I think it was. This is 65, 66, their first time in America, and the band that was playing was the Mother's Invention. So Giorgio and the band met Frank right then. That was the beginning of him meeting Frank. And he helped Frank later. So what else to say about that?
What's the name of that group?
So Michelangelo and the Yardbirds.
Okay. They sounded like they were influenced by, you know, Mediterranean or Bulgarian music, like something outside of the States.
Right. They were a blues band, and then something made them sound like that. I don't know. Zappa was influenced by Bulgarian music, but they hadn't met Zappa, I don't think, at that point when they made that song. But Clapton didn't like the commerciality of it, so he dropped out, and he went off. Maybe he got into heroin or something, and then he came back to Giorgio and said he didn't know what to do with himself, and you know, being a blues purist didn't work. So either Giorgio told him to form a group, or Eric was thinking of forming a group, and he asked Giorgio what could be a name for a group. So Giorgio says, well, you're the best. He was the best guitarist and whatever in London. So Cream rises to the top. Call yourself Cream. So he named them Cream, which, you know, became an icon of that name and that band.
Wow.
And there's a picture of he and Eric Clapton on the lawn of Lord Profumo, the famous Christine Keeler prostitute scandal in London around 62, 63. That is a movie. You can see it, the Profumo scandal. The Lord Secretary, or whatever he was involved with Christine Keeler, and that was a big scandal. I think he had to resign. There's a picture, George, you showed me, of him and Eric Clapton on the lawn of Lord Profumo bugging him about something, you know, pricking his conscience, complaining. And there's a young Eric watching Giorgio address Lord Profumo. And the reason Giorgio had the inside track on the Profumo scandal is that Christine Keeler and the other one that's in the movie, there's two of them, the press was following them around, so they wanted to go to some place that nobody would go to. So they went to Giorgio's little club. And then everybody started going there, I mean, in the underground. So Giorgio got a lot of attention with the up-and-coming mod scene people. Everybody passed through his club, but it began with those two girls, I think, going there. So George is a very interesting story. And when I spoke at the Drake Hotel on October 12, 2004, during the McLuhan Conference, and we're getting ready to bring Glow in from London to do the charades with Zappa, Joyce, and who would be the third one? Not Wyndham Lewis. Joyce Lewis. Joyce Zappa
McLuhan?
And someone else. Do you McLuhan, right. Yeah, McLuhan. So So when I introduced it, I said to these people something like, to the audience, I said, you're here because of two people. And I explained the McLuhan effect on the formal level. And then I said, on the content level, you're here because of Giorgio Gomelsky. And nobody knew who that was, so I explained what Giorgio had done. He was such a percolating point for many things in the 60s in London. And then he went on to New York City by 78, and then all these famous bands, the avant-garde guys like, what, Bill Frisell and those people, they all passed through his little space where they could rehearse and play. But Giorgio had a girlfriend on City Island where we worked or lived. So I would see Giorgio occasionally, you know, on the island. This is in like 2004, 2005, 2006, and 2007. And so one night I was at his place, at his girlfriend's place. So I played him my intro. It was on tape to see what he would say about what I said. And when he heard it, you know, I'm talking about McLuhan caused this plus Giorgio. So here's this guy, you know, on an island in New York who in ways nobody knows about him unless you're an insider in the industry because he hasn't written his book yet at that point. And I'm saying, I name him. And he listens. He goes, yeah, that's right, Bob. Yeah, I agree with that. He agreed to be linked in there with McLuhan and that he was a factor. Because the Stones brought the blues to people, and that was a big factor, you know, for the baby boomers. So everything spread out from that, a good chunk of it. And Giorgio advised the Beatles. What?
I just was going to interject quickly. Like, I just was going to say quickly that I was at the Drake recently, and I shouted out to you during What Use because I was like, oh, Bob was here. He made a big splash and made the Drake, blah, blah, blah. And I was at the hotel.
Who'd
so
you say
I,
that
I
to?
Who
did you say that to?
I said it to Nate, who I was with, and then I also posted it during What Use.
Oh, really? You posted a statement on the chat line?
Yeah. But you missed it. You and Dave were just doing great
yeah.
things on What You Get that week. But anyway, yeah, that was cool to be at.
Didn't I see the word Drake, and I said, oh, that's I didn't know it was you. I didn't know what I was. I think I related to that the hotel, but I didn't think the poster knew that because I didn't know who the poster.
Oh yeah,
was, but it was you.
Oh, I wasn't
so you guys
even
were
really
in the
able to
Drake
listen.
Hotel.
What?
Right, you were in the club. In the
yeah.
basement?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so what was
anyway,
I going to finish there?
Giorgio.
No, that's neat. Yeah, on this whole trip, we had a very good talk, you and I and Nate and Dave, the other day. So that was part of the trip, and you were in Drake. And you know the real history there. A pretty important event happened there. But about Giorgio. Somewhere in there before he was doing the Stones, because he was one of the few guys in London knew about the history of underground film, that's why Antonioni and these European filmmakers knew Giorgio. He'd been part of that scene since he was very young. He was born in 1934. So he advised the Beatles on Hard Day's Night. He was in on the planning of that big first film.
Oh, the film? Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah,
cool.
Hard Day's Night.
It, wow, he
might
really
have
got
had
around.
His ideas. Who got around?
This guy, Giorgio.
Yes. No, he's really important. He's a hidden ground. As a matter of fact, because his father was a Russian communist, whatever, and he got in trouble with Stalin, he had to leave the Soviet Union. So he did that, you know, around the time Giorgio was a few years old, and they end up in Switzerland. So John Bircher and those guys hated pop culture and rock and all that. They thought it was a communist conspiracy. They used to write about in the 60s and 70s. If they had found out that Giorgio, who was instrumental in so many scenes, you know, through the history of rock, if they knew Giorgio and that he came from the Soviet Union, that would be their proof. See, it is a communist conspiracy. It's created by Giorgio Gomelsky. But they didn't know about him. But you, in retrospect, you could think that. I mean, I was talking to Giorgio one time, and I met him the same night I re-met Ornette Coleman in Harold Channer's place in the summer of 2000. So What was I just starting to say about Giorgio? Forget what was it. I was going to say another thing about him.
What's his last name?
Gomelski, G-O-M-E-L-S-K-Y. Gomelski. And,
okay, yeah.
His club, he was
going to say you met him in New York.
Yeah, I met him at Harold Channer's in the summer of, in the summer of 2000. Harold Channer just discovered me. I'd just done the first TV broadcast with Alan Steinfeld. Then Channer had me on his show around June, and somewhere in there he invited me over to his apartment on, like, West 36th Street, say. And I'm up there and talking, and eventually I end up talking to this guy, and we have a long talk, and I don't know anything about him, but he has an interesting bunch of stuff to talk about. Oh, I remember what I was going to say. And that turned out to be Giorgio. So I met him without knowing anything about him, and then I learned more about it. But one thing he said is, you know, we've been fucked over by 5,000 years of merchants. He hated merchants. You're talking 5,000 years of a big mistake. That's a communist point of view, in a way, right? It's against business or capitalism or something. He talked like a communist, but he wasn't a communist. He was more of an anarchist aesthete and all this stuff. And so he would offer his place, which was on West 24th Street, forget the number, called the Green Door. And all the different avant-garde groups would rehearse in the studio, but he would put on performances, and the Green Party would be able to use his loft or his place to do their rallying and all that. So everybody knows Giorgio once you're inside in the industry. You know, everybody knows about him. And yet everybody keeps saying, write your book, but he never gets around to writing it. And he had his own personal project of interviewing everybody who was part of the rock and roll New York scene for 20 years. And he had a private site where he gathered all these interviews, and he let me into it. And I listened to all these interviews about everybody. I touched on some of them, but it was pretty amazing, all these obscure people that were club owners or magazine creators, key behind-the-scenes, not-known people, unless you knew they made the magazine or whatever. And they're all talking to Giorgio. It's pretty interesting. And I think Giorgio said the only Stone who mentioned Giorgio was Bill Wyman years ago, and then we found out, well, Keith Richards now can say he explains Giorgio. He brings him into his book, talks about his role. But I always find out the hidden people and everything, and that happened. So that night, after a couple hours talking to Gomelski, an old black guy looks over. I think he was listening to us, and he says, you, or he said something to me. And I look at him, I go, who are you? I just wanted his name, you know. Who are you? He goes, Ornette Coleman. I go, what? You guys know who Ornette Coleman is?
Mm-hmm.
Ever heard of him?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, I mean,
he's
that's a
one
big
of the most
deal,
famous
man.
Jazz
guys. Yeah.
I mean, that's like Duke Ellington. And Ornette Coleman, and he had a very thin face. You know, he's a lot older. Because I had met him and been at his studio in 72 or 73. In July 72, I was there for the Newport, New York, the first jazz festival. And I went down, and I knew about him. And I went down and knocked on the door of his operation there. And he answered, and we talked for a while. It must have been 73, because we ended up going to Carnegie Hall. He performed at Carnegie Hall. And there was Steve was there. And we went up to the back balconies of Carnegie Hall, looking down at the stage. And there was nobody there except for one dwarf woman and another guy in a T-shirt. And he looked sort of had a weird vibe. Well, once Ornette started playing, this guy in the T-shirt started yelling and screaming, like howling like an animal, and responding to the music, which was pretty intense. And, you know, great acoustics. And he went on and on. I was looking at him and wondering what's going on. That's sort of interesting. And then all of a sudden, the ushers come running after him. And they chase him all over the back balcony. They can't catch him. While he's yelling and screaming, the ushers are trying to grab him to tell him to shut up. And I remember the dwarf lady was really irritated by him. But I wasn't. I was sort of, this is a good response, a very nice response. And so I always remember that experience of Ornette Coleman evoking this wild man who started responding like a caveman, yelling and screaming to the point that the ushers had to drag him out. He was so loud and frenetic. But the so there, that's 1973, so like almost 30 years later, 2000. So he comes over, and we start talking, and he's standing there, and I'm just sitting there, and Georgia's listening, and we get into Finney's Wake and a bunch of interesting things. So eventually he says, here's my phone number. Give me a call. So I intrigued him what I was saying. So a week later I called, and he didn't answer, so I left a long message on his voicemail and my phone number, but he never called back. And then a few days later, maybe another week, I told Harold that Ornette didn't call back. He said, well, the problem is that Ornette smashed his hand just before you called him the first time. Like a few days after I met him, he smashed his hand and turned up it was pretty damaged for about a year. He couldn't play. And he's on a MacArthur grant, a MacArthur Genius grant. I don't know if you guys know about those. And,
no, wow. He couldn't
anyways,
play?
Anyways, he couldn't play for a year. His hand was really badly injured. So I called him when he was probably laid up, really in pain. So that's why he didn't get back to me. So we never reconnected. But it was great just being with him and interacting with him, just seeing how much his physique or his face had changed. So I met these two interesting people, Harold Channers.
He's still alive.
George Ugomelski and Ornette Coleman?
George
Coleman just died. Gomelski's still alive. You could go on, let me see, there's a YouTube. They have a party for him at his loft, and I think that's on YouTube. You could look at him. Let's see.
He just died this past June.
Yes.
Who, Ornette Coleman?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm putting in Giorgio Gomelski. Yeah, 75th birthday. First thing comes up. Well, look at that. Friends celebrate. So 1934 and 70s, 2009. And then there's him talking about this seems to be, and then he's on Harold Channers. There's a good bunch of videos. Definitely watch those. The birth of British R&B. There's like more stuff. They're interviewing him more now. I'm going to have to look at that. And they just closed it down. That's another thing. Farewell to Giorgio. They call it the Red Door, but I understood it was the Green Door, but maybe I had that wrong. So on B-Fire, man, look at all this stuff. Look, some of it.
Are you just Googling it?
Yeah, no, I'm just on YouTube. Just going on YouTube and put in Giorgio Gomelski and all these, him talking about everything. That's an education to listen to that.
Cool.
So I want to play. We're talking about Dio Fa just for a minute. Let me play you Dio Fa. I played it earlier, but just listen, look how it comes across, considering the concept. This is what it's called Dio Fa on Civilization Phase 3. So that goes on for 8 minutes. That sounds like a deeper resonant buzzing that I was trying to display with the over, under, sideways, down Yardbird song. That's mm-hmm. the distortion or the merging of separateness or physical, non-physical.
Man, I wish you could get right. people should listen to some of this stuff in good speakers, because the YouTube only can, it limits the frequencies.
Right.
It would be worth noting to go back and listen to some of that stuff with a good system.
Yeah, buy the CD. Get Civilization Phase 3.
Yeah.
Or DVD.
I gotta listen to it at Dave's studio.
Right. Yeah.
Big speaker.
So, is anybody now? Bert, have you heard me tell the Gomelski Ornette Coleman story before? I've told it before. Do you remember it?
I remember. I remember you describing the story about Ornette Coleman, but I don't remember it. That you were speaking with Giorgio Gomelski.
Good, good. I'm glad it wasn't boring for you. So,
No.
Look at those Gomelski videos. Just put YouTube Giorgio Gomelski. It's a whole page of him talking about his past, which is worth knowing about.
Yeah,
he's sort of considered a guy who had integrity. He worked at PolyGram in 68 or so, the corporate world, and he didn't like it, and he left it. And he had something to do with what's called the Canterbury Sound. Those guys, Henry, Robert Fripp and those guys. And then he went to France to sort of retire, and he did into writing books or something, and he was asked to put on a concert, and then it turned out to be a local interesting scene, and then he was asked to do another, and then he had a running this empire of alternative festivals all over Europe for a while, or at least all over France. So that got him in through the early 70s. And then he did this book. He translated Jacques Attali's The Sound of Music or something, which I just bought recently. But he then goes to New York, and he's always, like, bending over backwards, helping bands get started. So he never went into making a lot of money and going into a major record company. So he's respected on the level of a guy remained true to his anti-merchant principles and just fostered the culture.
That's great.